You know, I will not create a business enterprise and a professional legacy for myself at the cost of the legacy I build inside of the four walls of my house.
Welcome to ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. I say live, work, love Colorado because you and I define life in more than one dimension. My guests are successful entrepreneurs who strive for that kind of life. They could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Robert Thompson, CEO of Punchbowl Social, a restaurant and entertainment concept thriving in Denver and growing fast around the country. I got psyched preparing for this conversation because I can't figure out what separates winners and losers in the large-scale restaurant/entertainment business, or even which concepts will be winners and why. Plus, Robert, you have a fascinating background, and I'm glad you joined me. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Dave, for inviting me. I appreciate it.
This, I think, is going to be a really interesting conversation. If you have been to a Punchbowl Social, you'll know a lot about sort of what Robert and I are talking about. If you haven't, you'll want to go. First, I want to thank our sponsors, though, Community Banks of Colorado and MicroStar Keg Logistics. I appreciate their support for Colorado entrepreneurs and for this show. And so let's get started. And starting with this whole notion of really what Punchbowl Social is about, it's a huge footprint. You locate them, Robert, in urban sort of revitalization areas. Everything seems eclectic. Talk to us about sort of how you came up with this and what it's about.
Well, you know, so first what it is it's a large format scratch kitchen, craft beverage concept with a social gaming component to it. We do all this in a design forward environment. And you're right, we do like to find interesting structures and revitalize sort of either parts of towns or specific architecturally relevant structures and convert them into Punchbowl Socials.
Yeah, and these are big. Like, how square footage wise, what are you looking for? I know they vary, but they're big.
Yeah, you know, they range anywhere from 20 to 27,000 square feet. We also, you know, we're innovating a smaller footprint version of ourselves so that we can go into some smaller markets in the future. But right now, the convention is 20 to 27.
When you say social gaming, that's different. I haven't heard that term before. I think I know what it means, but what does it mean to you?
Well, you know, there are folks in this, I'm going to give you two terms. Experiential food and beverage, and eatertainment. And yeah. So those are used equally to describe the category that we're in.
Did you make those up or those are there?
You know, no. So there has existed experiential food and beverage. I opened up one 21 years ago in Nashville, Tennessee, you know, high volume bar with a billiard concept to experiences with food and beverage, right? But it's only been in the last 5-6 years we've started talking about experiences and experiential retail, that relates to the millennial demographic and their need to curate experiences around their lives.
And I've noticed from being in one of your Punchbowl Socials, this eclectic nature, and then on your website, you can see everyone is sort of this eclectic ambiance about it, everything from the food to the decor, the servers, the game. How does that fit the audience you're looking for?
You know, we like to say that everything that we do goes through an authenticity filter. And certainly our core audience can sniff out anything that's inauthentic and they won't participate in it. So, you know, millennials are very particular, right? And they don't want to be around anything contrived. So trying to create this air of warmth, you know, and invitingness, you know, in a very transparent culinary and beverage program, you know, all into that authenticity, and it comes together, I guess, as you're describing, and, you know, in an eclectic manner.
Yeah, you use the term authenticity, and that's used a lot now, and it's used in conjunction with the phrase or term millennials, right? I mean, is this something special to the age group of 25 to 30 year olds or 20 to 30 year olds, this notion of authenticity?
Yeah, I think I think it's just it comes from a cynical or critical place on their side, right? Where they just reject anything that they think is being, you know, pushed down their throats. You know, and if you look at some of these legacy brands within, you know, the restaurant space that have struggled with the millennial demographic, the Chili's, the Applebee's, these types of, you know, Fridays.
They're complete failures with that demographic.
They are, and it's just because you can't import authenticity. it's in your DNA or it's not.
Because I we're going to come back and we'll talk some more about that, because I'm really looking forward to exploring what makes certain concepts work and not work. And I, along those lines, I was, you mentioned being cynical about some of the terms. I'm cynical about some of this, the phrasing around brand promise. There's a lot of talk about brand promise, and there are branding experts that say that if customers don't stay loyal, it's because somehow the brand promise let them down. You know, what's your take on that? Is that just hyped or is that a real thing?
I think that's people that are paid to figure out ways to talk around those topics.
Yeah.
But what it's really about is, someone else is doing it better. You know, you might be fulfilling your brand promise and someone else comes along with a better brand promise. Millennials are not. And we can talk about millennials because that is my core demographic. Yep, and it's the largest demographic set, in the consuming community.
And so they're confounding to some and confoundingly difficult to attract and retain to many companies, right?
I think so, but I don't know that because we're pretty good at it, right? It's, we focus on them and it helps us cast a wide net because they're the most influential demographic set. They tell Gen X, my generation, and they tell Gen Z what's culturally relevant and they follow. So we focus on millennials and they lead everybody else. They're sort of the St. Patrick leading them.
Well, are they leading because they've got tons of disposable income and that's why people want them?
Well, they're leading because they really are defining what's culturally relevant in today's society. And what's interesting is I think, which is positive for Gen X, which is actually to look down a generation and say, can you keep me fresh? So I think that's a really positive thing about Gen X is they're not so arrogant and that they're willing to relearn a couple of things or remain open-minded. Whereas if you think about maybe our parents and the baby boomer generation, they weren't learning anything new.
Yeah. And I think to your point, you're a self-admitted Gen Xer, and it seems like you like the notion of being challenged to stay fresh.
Yeah. From an age standpoint, I'm an Xer, but my behavior patterns are more millennial. I'm a concept man and an operator in an industry that is consumer facing.
Yeah.
So I spent an entire lifetime or most of a lifetime, 100% of a career trying to maintain an understanding of the pulse and what's on trend. And so you can't just do that 18 hours a day and then go back into your Gen X mold, right?
You have to live it. It's a whole being, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're listening to ProCode 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is a show featuring entrepreneurs and business leaders who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. I'm speaking with Robert Thompson, CEO of Punchbowl Social. And you mentioned culturally relevant, being authentic, Robert. And then in an article I read about you in Inc. magazine, you talk about sweating the details on all of your properties. And so... question, do the details as the owner, as the CEO, do the details you care about, do you have any indication that those really resonate with your customers?
It's the absence of the bad things that these details speak to that put us in a positive light. And what I mean by that is just, I don't think most consumers don't notice what's when the bad things are absent, they only notice when they're there.
Yeah.
So
right.
It's, there's still a boring sausage making part to being, no matter how sexy your business is, there's still just the ABCs of it.
Well, when I think about yours, I mean, there's foosball going on, there's ping pong, there's cornhole going on, pool, all these other things. Do you think customers notice if there's something on the floor or if the music isn't the right tone? How does that play?
I think there's a mosaic at play here that a reality mosaic that they pick up on, right? And I believe that mosaic is flawed when those things are distracting to them.
So they may not consciously know it, but do you think that how well that mosaic works is what brings them back or doesn't? Yeah.
Look, we're trying to keep people in a happy place, right? And happy places don't have to have particularly strong articulated thoughts to them.
And do you think, as you build this mosaic, because one of the things I really wonder is, there's so many places, so many choices. Does this mosaic you paint bring people back again and again without them really even knowing why?
Yeah, I think so. I think it, it I mean, we're we're certainly attracted to our happy places.
Yeah. Right?
And places that feel warm and you leave with a good experience. And, you know, if you, you know, but of course you got to combine all that with some craveable food and beverage items, right? Mm-hmm. That you sort of, you're not quite sure whether you're going back for the environment or you're going back because you're craving that bite that you had last night.
Yeah.
Or, but that's okay, right? That's our job, just to put all those messages out there and let you glob onto the channel that registers with you.
You know, I never thought about it that way. This as a mosaic of pieces of an experience that people subconsciously don't even know why necessarily they're coming back to a Punch Bowl Social, but they left feeling, they experienced a positive thing and they left feeling happy.
It's part of the magic of our concept model also, that it's so complex and it's multi-layered, and a lot of other folks, and I think you want to get into this later about why things do and don't work, but
yeah,
you know, for us, it is that we're not reliant on just our menu. Right.
There's
you know, there's a celebrity chef out there, right? Or a guy that's just, that just created a restaurant and it's just about what he's doing from a menu innovation standpoint or a certain type of ethnic cuisine, right? He's substantially reliant on that. We have so many channels going on in Punch Bowl Social, which is what continues to help us, you know, increase sales and bring customers back, because we're just not getting stale.
Well, that you mentioned that I was going to talk about this later. I'm just going to talk about it right now, because you've got competitors that are big national chains, that are entertainment chains, that I don't have any interest in going to. What's the difference? And somehow they've sort of lost their mojo, right? So what's the difference? Is it just because they were first, but now you're creating a way different, more thoughtful experience?
It there really is a fundamental difference underlying my brand versus the other brands out there in the category, and it is, you know, it probably manifests most in the food and beverage discipline that we apply to these components of our concept model. So the Scratch Kitchen, it's very serious and very difficult to execute. The craft beverage is the same. How this comes together for us economically is that 89% of our sales are actually food and beverage. Nearly 100% of our competitors are 50% food and beverage and 50% gaming. That's almost a different, you know, we're out there taking business away from the casual dining space, as well as competing with our folks in the entertainment category. They're exclusively in this sort of gaming category. And, you know, we're just building a better mousetrap for a restaurant.
So what does that do, though, to your margins? Because if, well, of course, alcohol margins are fabulous. Mm-hmm. Food margins are crappy. And, but if, and so gaming, I guess, how does that all mix into where you come out okay?
Yeah. So, you know, we, some of our competitors, we understand, have better margins than we do, but they have lower gross volumes.
Yeah. They have lower sales per foot, don't they?
Yeah. So, you know, it works out in the wash. I think we have a superior model as a result. You know, if you can live at, you know, any bar and restaurant that can live at 20% store level EBITDA is knocking it out of the park, and we live there.
Yeah. Well, that's, I'm thinking listeners, because when I think about what the new experience would be, it's nice to have fun, it's nice to have games, and yet people in our market now want high quality beverages and high quality food. And I think that's where I think some of the competitors have maybe dropped the ball on that kind of thing, or at least that's just not where their niche has been.
Not where their niche is. It speaks to a certain discipline to try to push that culinary piece over the over the threshold. For myself, you know, I've been in this big box entertainment space since 97, but I've also won 4 Best New Restaurant awards along the way as well. Yeah. So I come from a restaurateur's background as well as this high volume gaming environment. So.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this too, because one of the things that strikes me, and as fast as you're growing, because now how many spots do you have? 11 Punch Bowl Socials?
14.
14. Okay. And so, and it was opening. 11. It was 11 when I started researching last night. I think so. And you've got 9 more coming on.
Between now and the end of 2019.
Wow. So here's something that fascinates me. There have been sort of niche-y, really cool, very attractive concepts that open. And for a while, every city wants them. And then there's this magic, weird point at which they start feeling like a chain. They go from, I want one, to, it's a chain. How do you manage that as you're deciding how fast to grow and what to do with this?
You know, we think that the definition of the modern chain is changing. It's evolving. You know, if a modern chain is a scratch kitchen with craft beverage, and we, and we source our, all natural products, and we are curating each of our new locations to reflect the market that we're in and the aesthetic and history and culture of that neighborhood, it will be a chain.
And at some point, though, I mean, I know you want to appeal to a millennial audience, and isn't some of the drive around that to try things that are truly unique and truly differentiated and separate and crafty as a concept? So how do you maintain that feeling when you're now at 20 units?
Yeah.
You must think about that.
We do. And you do have to create systems and consistencies. It's the only way to manage at scale.
Yeah.
But, we're creating systems and consistency for a product that we're very proud of. And I think, I think our audience is seeing that. It's no secret that we have, a large and growing footprint nationally. It's only the haters that that are out there that are really throwing this chain aspersion at us. Mostly everybody else goes, yeah, they're a chain, and I'm going tomorrow night.
Well, that's cool. So you haven't sensed that, and you don't anticipate sensing that.
No, because if you do it better than everybody else around you, I just don't see the consumer in San Diego saying, there's this concept that scores a 5 out of 10 that's next door to Punchable Social, who we consider, I don't know, what you make up the number, 8, 9 out of 10. We're going to go to this local one just because.
Forget about
the better experience.
So that, now I hear what you're saying, that the I'm going to use that term you used earlier, this mosaic of food and beverage and fun, and that if you can continue to maintain that with some sense of local feel, that you'll continue to be successful.
Yeah.
Do you see, because you've been in the business for a long time, do you see life cycles around certain concepts where no matter what happens, they cycle through?
I think that good food and beverage and service never get old. And I think that we, particularly for our business, we try to design in a relatively timeless manner, so that you're not going to look at us and go, yeah, that's so 2016, and I've seen businesses do that, right? And it's a bad idea. They grab a hold of, particular design
trends. The 50s diner or whatever, or Western or this and that.
In the late 90s, there were like, a bunch of lounge, velvety lounge things going on, right? Yeah. And now they're all out of business. But so.
And as you go to other cities, you're going to be attracting talent. It's a tough market to get talent to. What role does the talent play in the success of each operation? And to what extent do you have to tweak it, manage it, and differentiate your talent to make your successful, make your concept work?
Look, everybody has families to support. And so you got to pay well. And we think we do that. You have to give them something that they're proud in to get, to get up and go work at every day. And we think we operate in a culture of learning and education around Punchbowl. And so, but to answer your specific question, the talent and the people pipeline is everything. Because we can't, we can have the best concept model on the planet, and if we can't populate it with the team that knows how to operate it, it's forklift, right? It just sits there dormant.
Yeah, and doesn't success though beget success? I mean, if you open a concept successfully, you attract talent from other places, I think, wouldn't you?
We're fortunate right now and that we've got a lot of good recognition, and that's happening for us.
Yeah. Hey, I want to shift gears now, because I think I've got a better understanding. I think listeners have a better understanding of how you're driving the success of Punchbowl Social. And I want to back up a little bit your whole background. You have described in an Inc. article, you described your background, your past as sort of rudderless for a long time, right? Why'd you use that term?
It's a relative term. I've always felt like I wanted to do big things in my life, and that's probably not unique. A lot of us feel that way. But I didn't, for a stretch of my life. I was I dropped out of high school and then eventually went into took a GED and went to college, and then became a philosophy major, which you know, which doesn't really help you find a rudder, right? It just adds a lot more questions. But then you get really good at asking those questions, though, and then all of a sudden it becomes a tool.
I suppose, yeah.
And I decided that I felt the call of entrepreneurship, wanted to create things. And I was an operator in this industry, and I'm a creative writer. And so I found somewhere along the way that I was good at the design side of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then even a bigger surprise to me is that I was good at financial engineering without ever taking, you know, any business classes. So that really cemented me and set me on this path.
Why'd you choose philosophy? Or why'd you think you wanted to be in philosophy?
Well, it wasn't to get dates, that's for sure.
No, maybe not.
It was, I had some big questions, you know, and somewhere along the way, when I was around 19, I had an epiphany that my questions were going to be more math based or more intangibly based.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, we're either going to talk about the things that are squishy, or you're going to talk about the absolutes. And I feel like there's more power in the intangible than the absolute.
Yeah. I think that may be truer than ever because our world seems so complex. Has your philosophy background helped you deal with some of that as you're building your business?
It has helped me in every part of my life. It helps me. It helps me ask the right questions. It's created an analytical side to me that helps me get through, you know, the murkier parts of personal or, you know, and especially professional decision making.
Well, that's cool. And I suppose you learned some of that the hard way too, because I know in your background you had some rough rounds and you know, you got knocked down a couple of times, but
yeah.
But you come back. So can you share a specific example of one of those kind of circumstances?
Well, I've had two careers. You know, I started off early. I opened up, you know, when I was 25 years old, as I mentioned, I discovered that I was good at financial engineering these deals and raising capital, and raised $2.2 million and opened up a 23,000 square foot upscale billiard parlor in a restaurant in Nashville, and had a lot of success. Went on to open several more places, won a lot of awards, made a lot of money. And then, you know, I think, unfortunately, I'd never really experienced failure and probably got too far ahead of myself. And
did you think you were infallible?
Well, I thought that my method, right? I thought that my business method, I could go in, I could concept and design and operate my way out of any real estate that I chose to put one of my concept in, and, you know, found out the hard way that that wasn't true. So, and ultimately found, you know, had a series of bad luck, and a couple of things went poorly, and found myself completely wiped out. So in 2003, so I had to, after that, I had to decide whether I was going to move on to something else in life or if I was going to continue in this industry.
Yeah.
And I'm a fairly stubborn, irrational individual at those times, you know, and decided that I couldn't let this industry beat me. And I was going to, you know, for better or worse, I was going to come back at it.
Well, I read a quote. You said, "No way I'm going to walk away from an industry that punched me in the face."
That's right.
So, you know, you used a phrase, you had a couple of unlucky situations happen. And typically, successful entrepreneurs don't talk about being unlucky ever. They either fail or they don't fail. Why'd you use the term unlucky?
Well, so, you know, some of it, I put myself in a bad position for bad luck to occur. So, you know, I made some bad decisions. I had a restaurant that it was an amazing concept. And, one of the ones I won Best New Restaurant for was written up in Gourmet Magazine, and, you know, and lost money every single day for a year and 1 month.
But, boy, that must have been weird, right? You're getting written up as an award winner, and yet you know you're losing money.
A little too far out ahead from a trend standpoint back in 2003. I brought something here to Denver that Denver wasn't quite interested in yet. I had a very loyal following for the folks that understood what we were doing, and then everybody else sort of ignored us.
Wow. When you think back about this notion of being punched in the face by an industry and then wanting to come back, I mean, as an entrepreneur, I've had some lows that are beyond, I think, what anybody could, who hasn't been through it, could really experience. I mean, the feeling of, am I going to lose my house, or, you know, those kind of things. And explaining to one's spouse, like, why you're borrowing money to make payroll and not bringing any money home. I mean, you must have had some of those real gut check moments.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, all that happened, right? So I lost all my businesses. I lost my house.
Wow.
Yeah, I lost everything. I went from, you know, a pretty successful career at a young age to, you know, to literally not having enough money to necessarily feed myself adequately.
Wow.
It was that extreme.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I think I've kind of lived a life of those sorts of extremes.
When you think back on it, can you still feel it, or are you past it?
Past it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I beat it. And you know, when I beat something, I look back on it as a sense of pride, not a, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in my whole life is going through that, counterpunching and being where I'm at today. It's part of the composite of who I am.
Yeah. I want to talk about that with how you raise your kids in a little bit too. I'm going to be interested in that. I wanted to share with you that I'd been reading this book called The Ideal Team Player, and an attribute it celebrates is this notion of being hungry. And it states that you can tell a lot about someone's hunger by how hard they worked as a teenager. What were you doing as a teenager?
As a teenager, you know, I think I was, that's when I was really profoundly rudderless. It was, you know, I had an odd family situation. So parents were split up. I moved out when I was 16. You know, I was just, when you're 16 and you're out of the house, right?
Yeah.
You're a lot of time is spent just kind of thinking about how you're gonna, you know, make enough money to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, did construction jobs and, you know, worked in auto body shops and stuff like that along the way. So, you know, I was just surviving.
Yeah. Were you working hard to survive?
Relatively. Yeah. I like to have a good time too, though. So yeah. I was trying to figure out that life balance between having a good time and working
at
hard.
16
years old, I'm out of the house, man.
Yeah. Do you think you're a hard worker?
Am I a hard worker?
Yeah.
I'm averaging 4 hours of sleep the last 7 days. So, I don't know. Maybe ask others if I'm a hard worker. I know I'm putting the time in.
Yeah. You've said that Ayn Rand has made you a better capitalist. Right. So what does that mean to you? And why do you care about being a better capitalist?
You know, I don't want to go too deep here because we could waste your whole podcast.
I'm interested in it because capitalism has sort of gotten this, I think, a bad rap.
Yeah, I agree.
And to me, it's this positive, virtuous thing. And so I'm interested in your take on why you want to be a better capitalist.
Look, it's a way to help society. I have thousands of employees, and I have a large percentage of them that are in management and salaried, right? And, you know, the waiters and the bartenders are all, you know, we're a means to an ends for a lot of those folks, right? Mm-hmm. They're using us more than we're using them. They're getting through college.
Yep.
They're waiting to move on to their quote unquote real career, or they move into management with us. But, we support hundreds of families. Through what we do. And if I can't be a better capitalist, if I can't figure out a way to manipulate the market and beat my competitors, then I can't provide for those folks. And I don't want to act like I'm absolutely this altruistic individual who only does what I do for the betterment of society. That, you know, but it is something I feel good about.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always, I mean, that's my take. I really do believe that capitalism is virtuous. Sadly, it's been abused by a lot of people, and it seems like an increasing amount feel that that's okay.
But that starts to bleed into a different category. There's a difference in capitalism and just fat greed.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I, you know, have had success, and I, you know, every time I negotiate a real estate deal or I bring in new capital to help, you know, grow this company, you know, there are, You know, there are winners and losers on both sides of those transactions, often both sides. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to be able to put together, you know, these deals and, you know, in the right way that, you know, where we try to win more than they do and we can help our people.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, the tough business that you're in. And so if you can't structure the deals properly, you can't succeed.
Yeah.
We've been talking about some of your values, especially around how you were raised. And I know you live in Colorado with your wife and sons. And then you also talked about only getting 4 hours of sleep a night. So how do you manage this? Because it sounds like, from what I've read about you, that you value your family life.
I do. Well, part of the reason I only get the 4 hours sleep is, you know, so I was up working till 1 a.m. last night, but you know, I wanted to be up at 5:30 today so I could play with my kids for, you know, an hour and a half before they went to school.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So otherwise I could have been sleeping.
Yep.
But then it was, you know, my wife takes them out the door to school and, you know, and I'm off to work.
Yeah. Oh, I remember the times I'd come home from work, have dinner, see the kids, put them to bed, go back to work, right, till midnight or whatever. And that's just the life.
The way it goes. And I, you know, it's a balance. It's an effort, but you know, I will not create a business enterprise and a professional legacy for myself at the cost of the legacy I build inside of the four walls of my house.
Wow.
So it doesn't mean that I'm gonna back off on my business aspirations. It just means I'm gonna put in more time and work harder at home too.
Yeah. So what do you want to teach your sons about life and about adversity and things like that that you from your background bring?
You know, I think that, you know, you got to manage the highs and the lows and don't ever get caught up in either one of them. I have an example I thought about a few years ago where, you know, when I was living it, I thought this is something when my sons are old enough, I want to teach them. Hmm. And it was the within 48 hours, I found out my dad had terminal cancer in the same time that I got the financing together for a deal that was sort of make or break in my company.
Oh, gee.
And I thought, you know, when my boys are old enough to understand this, I want to share with them that is life.
Yeah.
You know, I just happen to have it clustered together, you know, inside of 7 days and actually closer to 2 or 3 days. Mm. So I got this great news and this bad news all at the same time. And that's what you're going to manage during your life. And those that can push through the middle of that, not go up high or low, are the ones that are going to be more successful.
Yeah. Is there sort of a mantra or piece of advice you think that you'll share with your sons that you want them to sort of carry with them?
Yeah. It's so many, but there are, you know, there's... I want them to be careful not to be too obsessive because I think it's a flaw of mine, right? There's a difference between drive and becoming, you know, overly obsessive. And, you know, my oldest son is named Gavin, and that's a derivative of Gawain from Gawain and the Green Knight. And you know, that story is really fascinating to me. And because I think, you know, Gawain let himself down in the Green Knight because he broke his own, some of his own principles at the end of that story. And he came out on the other side and he ultimately forgave himself. And I think if you're overly too obsessive, you can have a hard time forgiving yourself or, you know, for whether it's a mistake or a personal flaw, whatever it is. And I literally named my oldest son because I want to try to teach him to be careful. There's rigor and there's discipline and you want to fight and scratch to try to get ahead. Mm-hmm. But there's also be careful.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not everything. You got to try to figure out, you got to see the mosaic.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I didn't even have it on my outline. You're making me think of it. And that's that when you were growing up, you had a challenging life and you had to fight and scratch and make your way. Your boys aren't going to have those challenges.
Yeah.
So I always wonder, and I talk with friends about this too. It's like, how hard is it to raise kids with solid values like we do when they don't have to fight and scratch to survive?
I don't think values come from dire circumstances, right? I mean, I don't have any doubt that my children are going to grow up understanding what's right and what's wrong and the value of working hard and not having everything handed to them. So I guess I kind of challenge that maxim that you know, most of us probably believe is true.
I'm not sure it's a maxim, but it does something I wonder about. Yeah. And I worked hard at as a father with a business. You know, how do you make sure that the values that are important to me are ones that do get translated down? And
you know, there's no doubt that my kids see how hard I work, right? And that's you know, if I'm modeling for them, you know, there's no way that these guys are going to come, you know, out of childhood and wonder whether there's a purpose to a hard day's work.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose that's the same thing within your own business, right? You model the behavior that you'd like your team to have. Yeah. And I'm going to wrap up, and I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and today on ProCo 360, I've been speaking with Robert Thompson, CEO of Punchbowl Social, a restaurant and entertainment concept thriving in Denver and growing fast around the country. And what a great conversation it's been. Thank you, Robert.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. And to the listeners, thanks for joining us on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I define success in more than one dimension. My guests, as you heard today, are world-class entrepreneurs who could be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. Please help this show thrive by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast via your app and by submitting a review. Also, please subscribe to the newsletter at proco360.com. Thanks again to show sponsors, MicroStar Keg Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, Jones & Keller, and the Colorado Chamber of Commerce. And thanks to Mike, my show engineer here at Third & James Studios. Thanks all for listening, and thanks for sharing.